You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode one of the Mammal Watching podcast with me, John Hall, in New York City.
And me, Charles Foley, in Minneapolis. And today we have a real treat because our first guest is Mac Hunter. Now, Mac is an eminent scientist, as well as a long-term mammal watcher, and also happens to be a good friend of mine. And I have traveled a lot with Mac and his wife, Aram, in Africa to South Africa, Tanzania, we've been to Brazil, and also various places in the US, including on one very fun trip to go and see black-footed ferrets in South Dakota. And in fact, there's some good stories about that trip, but perhaps left to another occasion.
Well, this is something I need to hear. Looking forward to Mac. He's written some great reports, and I feel like I know him well already just from those. What's been happening with you this week, Charles?
I've been following a story that I've been tracking for a number of years now about cheetah being reintroduced into India. And it looks as though this is actually going to happen. So by way of a bit of background, cheetah were native to India. In fact, they were quite common over there. And then they went extinct in the 1940s because of overhunting and habitat loss. And since then, there have been various efforts to reintroduce them into the country. And it sounds as though they will be introducing 8 cheetah from Namibia into Kuno National Park in Madhya Pradesh. Now, this has proven quite controversial with some conservationists who, for a start, worry about introducing a non-native subspecies into an area, and also worry that the park in question may be too small and may not have the prey base to actually sustain a viable population of cheetah. Now, the romantic in me says I would love to see cheetah in India again. And indeed, if all of the facets came together, this national park would ultimately have lion, leopard, tiger, and cheetah.
Oh, wow.
Quite remarkable. But in general, I am averse to having a species or a subspecies introduced if it's non-native in the area, and unless there's a compelling reason to do so. But it's obviously going to go ahead, so we will see what happens.
Oh, exactly. There's so many examples from around the world where things have been introduced, sometimes deliberately, including in Australia, and they've had a devastating impact. So hope it works out for everything in that ecosystem, but an exciting story. Thanks, Charles.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And how about you, John? What's been happening at your end?
Well, mainly working on this podcast, Charles, as you know. It's been a lot of fun. But I am traveling soon. I'm heading to Mexico at the weekend for a week chasing bats and rats, mainly in the northwest around Mazatlan. So it looks like a gorgeous area. There should be some new mammals for me, but maybe not the safest of places at the moment with all the cartels, but I'm assured by my friend who's I'm traveling with, who's Mexican, that he knows the safe places. But if you do see a photo of someone looking like me on CNN hanging under a bridge over the Rio Grande, then it probably is me. So could you please update my mammal list?
Of course, John, of course, no worries.
Thank you, Charles. That's the important stuff.
Yeah, one of the things that we should think about is if you were going to have a last mammal to see, what would it be, your epitaph species? It's anyway, perhaps for another podcast.
Perhaps, but I'm pretty sure that the last thing I do see will be a mammal, seeing some of the places we've been and things I've done. And the other thing I've been doing, and this would be a good last mammal to see, is I've been drooling over recent videos on Facebook of tufted ground squirrels in Borneo in the Tawau Hills. For those who don't know, this is definitely the world's best squirrel. They're a very large squirrel and they have an absolutely humongous tail. And I don't know why they're called ground squirrels, because nearly all the pictures I've seen of them are in trees. To add to their mystique, the local hunters in Borneo believe they attack mouse deer by dropping from a branch onto the deer and biting the jugular. So absolutely crazy animals and something I'm desperate to see.
Oh, love to see one of those as well. Although, frankly, I think that some of the gray squirrels out over here in Minneapolis probably can kill people by attacking the jugular as well.
You should see the ones in New York. They have no fear.
Right. So I am very pleased to introduce Mac Hunter. Mac, welcome to the podcast. And can you tell us a bit about yourself?
I'm a professor of wildlife conservation at the University of Maine. I've been here for a few decades, studying mostly birds and herps in a forest ecology context, but a fair bit of small mammal work. And occasionally I've ventured out and I've done a bit of work on red pandas, African buffalo, and so on.
And Mac, you have been involved with various sort of conservation organizations for a while, because you were the president of the Society for Conservation Biology for a year or two. Is that correct?
Yes, back in 2001 through 2003, I was the president, and I'm very active in the society all through the 90s and 10s or whatever they are.
Right. And also you've done quite a lot of work with the Nature Conservancy in Maine, haven't you, as well?
Yes, actually, and Maine and globally. I'm very active in local land conservation here in Maine in particular. I probably should have said earlier, I'm semi-retired now, only working 25% or getting paid for 25%, working more like 50 or three quarters, but when I'm not working, very active in land conservation circles.
I always get a real thrill when, you know, serious scientists like yourself and Charles and conservationists have sort of gotten onto the site and they're using it both for their own, because I know you're both mammal watchers, obviously, but also that you can see the scientific and conservation benefits of this hobby of ours. What do you think is the potential for mammal watching to really help with conservation?
Well, there's two things come to mind. Obviously, a lot of people speak of ecotourism and the possibility that that can support conservation in countries where economic input from enterprises like this can be real drivers to conserving places where people want to come mammal watch. That's pretty obvious. And then there's also the citizen science aspect of it. That hasn't been pursued as well for mammals as birds in particular, or even butterflies. But there's potential there for meaningful data to be obtained by mammal watchers. They're fortunately, these days, people are almost always out with a camera in their pocket through their cell phone. So documenting what they find, where they found it, could be quite helpful in terms of atlasing projects.
Yeah. No, I remember I was in, the first time this came to me, sort of hit me, was when I was in Java about 10 years ago. And I was in, I think, Haliman National Park and took some pictures of this rather strangely colored small tooth palm civet in a tree. There were several of them right above the ranger station. I thought, it's just a small tooth palm civet. Put them on my website. And a couple of years later, a bunch of researchers from Germany got in touch, like really excited. This was the first record of this species for over 100 years. They thought they'd gone extinct. And there they were, living right where the rangers were. But just no one had been there. So there's definitely potential.
That's great. Yeah. And the one that many people seem to be using now is iNaturalist.
Yes.
And I know there are some records for Tanzania, which is where I spent most of my time working. But John, you put me onto this fairly recently, and I was in Arizona, and you said, look, just check out iNaturalist, and you can actually use your phone, you can locate where you are and search for certain species, and it'll show you any records that you found in your general area. So it was great. I tried it for spotted ground squirrel, and I can tell you exactly where spotted ground squirrel are not found in Arizona. But it's something I think can actually be quite useful for mammalologists in general.
Yeah. Well, we've initiated a reptile and amphibian atlasing project for the state of Maine back in 1984. It's actually one of the first citizen science approaches to herps. And We're gearing up to do a third edition of our book on Maine herps, and iNaturalist is turning out to be by far the best way to get records into the system. It's very efficient.
That's great.
You know, Matt, you talk about herps, and you mentioned earlier that you did some work on birds, etc. Now, you're not your sort of like average mammal watcher. You and your wife, Aram, who's also a professor at University of Maine,
right.
You've sort of taken a slightly different approach to mammal watching. Can you fill us in on that?
Yes, well, there's two answers to that. One, I really am heavily invested in mammals. I mean, it goes back to my very earliest roots. My mother shared with me the like a memory book of my childhood, and apparently my first word was mama, second was papa, third was fox, raccoon, squirrel. they were all, and they weren't, you know, puppy and kitty. They were all wild mammals. Eight of the 10 of my first words. My parents would trot me out because they thought I was something worth bragging about, because I could say squirrel when I was 14 months old. So it is true that mammals have been a big part of for me for a very long, long time. But in a bigger context, Aram and I are really into all the vertebrate animals, and our goal in life is to see as many of the vertebrate families as possible. We got through the birds in about 25 years to get to all but one of the bird families. We're waiting for things to get a little more pleasant to travel to the Philippines to finish off that list. But for the last 10 or so years, mammals have been our trying to see all the mammal families that we practically can have been a big part of it. And as that unfolds, we're keeping track of the herps and make some special efforts for them and fish. We're scuba divers, so we've actually seen more families of fish than any other, because there are so darn many. So at last count, we're up to 126 of the 159 mammal families recognized in the Handbook of Mammals of the World. And we're just going to keep cranking away at them. Unfortunately, we're down to mostly bats and rats at this stage. All the great exciting ones that are sort of are mostly behind us. Fingers crossed for a linsang at some point, or pygmy right whale will be amazing if we ever pull that one off. But
yeah,
there was one in pygmy right whale. The only one I was sort of heard about that was seeable, and it was before I was there. I think there was one in Albany in Australia hanging out.
That's right. I remember that.
Months. There was also one off Cape Town quite more recently, but yeah, that's a really hard one, but I'd love to see that.
That's one of those that you have to be in your situation, Mac, retired. Basically, you hear about it, you jump on the plane and off you go. Otherwise.
A lot of our friends accuse us of being jet setters, but I can't quite see myself dropping everything and flying to Australia to on the chance of glimpsing a right whale.
Never say never.
Yeah,
exactly. It's I think it's a really interesting approach, that taking, looking at families. I do vaguely remember now swimming down some river in Brazil looking for some type of fish.
That's right.
I can't quite remember what that was, but anyway, not quite sure how I let you talk me into that.
That was wasn't that a fabulous experience?
It was great, Mac.
I think we got three families of fish that day.
What are some of your other favorite mammal watching experiences?
Oh my goodness. See, I anticipated this question, of course, and interestingly enough, I mean, I've been two or three trips a year for decades all over the world. So I've had all the classic experiences with polar bears and tigers and gorillas and so on. But I have to say, arguably my most memorable experience was right here in Maine, off the coast of Maine with northern right whales. Of course, special because they're, you know, one of the rarer species of mammals, just a few hundred of them left. And I've been lucky enough to see them many times. Unfortunately, not with Charles when he visited me. I think it was a weather issue. As I recall, we couldn't get offshore for the few days you were with us, if I recall correctly.
Story of my life, Mac. Yes.
But I, the very first time I went out with a team of researchers from the New England Aquarium, we experienced what's called, they call a SAG, which means either surface active group or sexually active group, depending on who you ask. And basically it was a dozen male right whales churning the surface into a trough, trying to access a single female. And we watched this from a few boat, like five boat lengths away for 30, 40 minutes before it dissipated. That was unbelievable to see. A dozen gigantic mammals frolicking. If I'm not sure frolicking is quite the right verb, but they were very agitated. It was quite amazing sight.
I can imagine.
That's fantastic. And what's the current status of them at the moment? Because it's not looking good, is it?
Well, there was a lot of concern two or three years ago. They had a series of mortality events. Basically, what happened is probably tied to climate change. They are no longer spending the summer off our coast. They come here. A few of them hang around, but it looks like most of them are continuing north up towards the St. Lawrence River. Off near the Gaspé Peninsula, and they're getting into trouble up there. They in terms of ship strikes and the like. It's a, you know, major shipping heading into the St. Lawrence there, and so there were, I forget the numbers, but a worrying number of adults were killed in one summer a few years ago. And then we had a couple of years with little or no reproduction. So people have been extremely worried. But happily, this past spring, as we speak, there are, I forget how many, but a non-trivial number of calves, something like, I want to say 15 to 20 calves were born this year. It was a very good year for maybe the second or third best year on record for calving. And so people are, and the situation in the up off the Gaspé with ship strikes seems to have gotten under control. Whether it's rerouting the shipping or what, there hasn't been a repeat of that experience from a few years ago with massive mortality in a single summer.
Oh, that's heartening to hear.
And yeah, so things are looking still a little better.
Can you still see them off the coast of Maine? Is that if mammal watchers wanted to snag one, where would you go and look?
Honestly, right now it would be challenging because they do show up there. I saw one last summer, but they don't hang around, or not, certainly not in the numbers that they used to. So it's become a bit of a needle in the haystack. And in theory, you could go up to where they are spending much more of their time in the last few summers off the Gaspé Peninsula in Quebec, but they are far offshore there. I've asked friends about this, and they said, ask him, is there going to be a whale watching industry developer around their presence off the Gaspé? And they said, probably not. It's just they're too far out. It's too challenging.
Because I saw them off Nova Scotia. There was a big group, I think, resident there in the summer, and I saw them at the end of the season again, probably 10, 12 years ago. Are they still Are they not using that area anymore? They moved.
No, that population is more or less the same one in the Bay of Fundy.
Bay of Fundy, exactly.
Yeah, and they sort of come together and apart. And I believe I'm correct in saying that the Nova Scotian ones have moved up towards Quebec as well. They do have pretty good luck with them off Cape Cod. As they move through Cape Cod, the whale watch boats, there's a period in, I think it's April, when they have pretty good luck with them off Cape Cod as they're moving. They spend the winter down off Georgia and Florida.
Right. Okay. May have to add that to my diary, I think. What have some of your other sort of mammal highlights been, Mac?
Oh, goodness. I was thinking about, I've been at this for so long. I mean, one of the benefits of it is that my first trip to Africa was 45 years ago now, and and things were rather different there. I remember seeing zebra and giraffe from the plane as I landed in Nairobi, and within the very next morning, I'm on the shores of Lake Naivasha, wading around up to my chest through the papyrus looking for hippos. And the day after that, I was charged by a black rhino. I'm not exaggerating when I say the very first rhino I ever saw was 15 meters away and charging straight at me when I first saw it. That's, of course, reflective of my age as much as anything, and digging back through memories like that. I have to say that I'm very lucky in terms of where I live. I don't think, when you visited us, Charles, we were still living on the river near the university.
Correct. Yes, and, that's right.
Well, we've moved into out into the country from there, and I can literally walk out the back door and go 50 kilometers in a straight line and not cross a public road. So we see bear, moose, bobcat, fisher, pine marten, all are visible within a stone's throw of the house here. Not on a daily basis. Not like I could take you out this afternoon and show you a pine marten, but they're out there. Just the day-to-day stuff is pretty special as well.
So do you have any, one of the questions we wanted to ask was whether you have any tips on how to find certain species? I know you've seen some like really interesting stuff over the years.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, I don't have any great insights, and certainly to you two, oh my goodness. But to state the obvious, for most species, if you're in the right time at the right place, you're going to have a very high likelihood of success. So it's a matter of figuring that out. And in some cases, like two that come to mind, are Selenodon and II, which, mm-hmm. you know, left to your own devices, you could spend a lifetime wandering around and not see either of those, but you get the right person to take you to the right place at the right time. They're pretty darn easy now. Yeah.
Did you see the Selenodons in the Dominican Republic with that father and son combo?
Exactly. same experiences as you there. It was quite magical.
And the II, was that in Ferencvaros Forest?
It's a new site just outside the near Ranomafana National Park.
Yes,
and it's the cheat there is that they've got radios on them.
Oh, well, I hadn't heard of that one.
Yeah,
you kept that one to yourself, didn't you?
That was a trip reporter.
Was it? Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, maybe I should see it.
Max trip report is on the Madagascar page, and you also got sucker-footed bats there, which is another family of mammals I haven't seen.
Yeah, same day, same site.
Two families in a day.
They were quite, The folks there were quite used to people coming to see the II's. That was all very easy to organize. When I started asking about sucker-footed bats, that took some digging, but I found somebody who had been a research assistant for somebody who'd studied them 10 years ago and knew how to go find them. It was pretty straightforward, really.
Oh, fantastic. I think I know where my next trip will be.
I do remember seeing II's off a, again, close to Ramanapana, but there's a little lodge over there, and there was an island where they were native, and then they essentially cut the island off. It wasn't an island, it was part of the mainland, and then they sort of made a little trench so the II's couldn't leave, and then they added some more, and they sort of feed them. So you go there, and it's wonderful to see them. You get a fantastic view, but they're not really wild, at least not in my opinion, so... Yeah.
We had actually the my first II experience involves our mutual friend David Wilcove, a trip to Madagascar, I think it's about 12 years ago now. And II's were a target for us then. And we were out one night, and the our guide points to some eye shine in a tree that's roughly 200 meters away and says, that's an II. So we're all looking through our binoculars, and literally all we can see is two eyes reflecting back. So how do we know? He might be right, but but no corroborating it. But we were, a guy named Larry Masters was with us, and he took photographs of these eye shines. Went home and did some digital magic, and you could actually see a bit of a silhouette of the animal behind the eye shine, and so it started looking a little bit promising. At least it was the right shape and size. You could tell that, and then Don David Wilcove went and got one of his graduate students to artificially doctor it up so that it went one more pass of digital optimization. He made that photograph look like where you open up your file and you say, oh my God, it is an II. But it was all him pulling a fast one on us. That said, a friend, I don't know if you know her, Eleanor Sterling from the American Museum of Natural History. She did her PhD on II's. I showed her the second optimized photograph, and she looked at it, where it was, time of day, time of night, time of location, et cetera. She said 95% likely that was an II. But talk about meaningless.
Yeah, exactly. All that does is tempt you, you know.
Right. So we had to go back and get a good one.
Yeah,
fair enough. And so obviously you've been doing this for 25 years or so. Things must have gone wrong at some time. What experiences can you tell us about that?
Well, I actually the one thing that comes to mind was the Dryandra Forest in Western Australia, where we went for numbats, and we were really, really keen to see numbats, and we worked our tail off for 3 days, just trying to be as strategic as possible. Whatever, we did everything humanly possible to see a numbat. And it got to a point where on late in the afternoon on the third day, I said, sorry, we got to go. We want to be at our next destination, actually down in Albany, before dark. So we got to leave. So we reluctantly got in the car, drove out of the little parking lot at the picnic ground, and a numbat ran across the road right in front of the car. And we were to jump out and follow it for the next 30 minutes. So that was unbelievable serendipity. I mean, literally three more seconds, and we would have missed it.
Those are the best, aren't they?
There's 2 minutes of midnight sightings. Yeah, all that foreplay. It's definitely worth it. I had a funny experience in Dryandra. I mean, I went there desperate to see a number, and this was in in 2000, and they just started the fox baiting there. Numbats were in decent numbers, and the way to see them is just to drive in the daytime. That's the way they survey for them. And I think it would be like 2 days there. I was with my ex-wife, and then on the third day she saw one and I didn't. Now, I'm not saying that's the only reason she's my ex-wife, but I think it speeds things up. But no, I did see one the next day, but they're just a stunning creature. And the numbers are actually back up again. They went, last few years they've been seemingly not doing so well, but I think there's a record number have been seen or born in the last few months. So that's just a gorgeous, gorgeous animal.
Yeah.
All right. I think the sort of last question we have to ask you is, what's next? I know you're on a quest to see all the families. Are there any top of your list?
Well, with any luck, we're hoping to get to Chile this year. That's our we haven't put our money on the barrel, so to speak, but that is the plan, to get to go back to Chile. We were there once before, but at that time, it was long enough ago that we weren't really focused on obscure mammals like the Monito del Monte. So we're going to go back. We have a friend of a friend who's a researcher working on them, and so with any luck at all, we'll get that little monotypic marsupial family. And then and actually we have not seen mountain lions, so although we tried very hard for them in Torres del Paine. This is back in the days when before they really were set up to take people out and show them. So we'll go back and go out with one of the people who figured out how to show them pretty reliably to people.
Fantastic. Sounds like a good trip.
Well, Mac, thank you so much for
It was fun, obviously.
Thank you very much.
Fun to have a chat. It will be interesting to see if this can be made palatable for an audience.
I think it already is.
I certainly enjoyed it.
I think people are going to be lining up to hear about it, Mac. So no worries there, mate.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.